Judges have no expertise. It's up to the Congress to have hearings, up to the Congress to find facts, up to the Congress to find out what goes on in the real world. And in Wirtz in 1968, and reaffirmed recently in Gonzalez versus Reich, after Morrison, after Lopez, quote, where we find the legislators have a rational basis for finding a chosen regulatory scheme necessary to the protection of commerce, could apply as well to disability. Our investigation is at an end. What's wrong with that test? Would you subscribe to that test over the proportionate and congruence test?
There are a number of tests that have been used and proposed over the years in this area, and this is the subject, I think, of continuing litigation in the Supreme Court. There is the Maryland versus Wirtz approach, and then the City of Burney approach. And you mentioned that the City of Burney is a relatively recent decision, and it's been followed by a number of subsequent decisions.
Where did it come from? Where did the Burney test on proportionate and congruence come from, if not thin air?
Well, I think it was an effort by the majority in that case to identify a standard that would not strictly limit congressional power to remedying established violations of the 14th Amendment while still, in their view, retaining the necessary remedial connection to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. And it is an approach that they have used in a number of cases, and the cases have not come out. Sometimes the results in the cases have not been predictable. You mentioned the contrast between the two decisions under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I think Nevada versus Hibbs was a decision that some people that surprised some people based on the court's prior precedents. So there's, I think, still some ferment in this area, and I'm sure it is a question that is going to be that will come up in future cases.
Well, we're speaking not only to you, Judge Alito, but to the court. Court watches these proceedings, and I think they ought to know what the Congress thinks about making us school children or challenging our method of reasoning. We're considering legislation which would give Congress standing to go into the Supreme Court to uphold our cases. Right now, the Solicitor General does that, but he's in the executive branch. We don't want to derogate the Solicitor General in your presence, Judge Alito. The thinking that we've had was to speak about your decisions, the court's decisions on the floor, the Senate. Nobody pays attention to that. Maybe we would try to come in as amicus. Why do that? We have the power to grant standing. We can grant standing to ourselves and come into court and fight to uphold constitutionality. Let me move at this point to the recent legislation which takes away the jurisdiction of the federal bench to hear habeas corpus decisions. It's in the context of the detainees. Justice O'Connor and Hamdi laid out the law in flat terms. All agree that absent suspension, the writ of habeas corpus remains available to every individual detained within the United States, every individual, not just citizens. And then she spells out the way you suspend the writ, and you do it only by rebellion or invasion. And then this recent legislation says the District of Columbia Court of Appeals shall have the exclusive jurisdiction to determine the validity of any final decision by the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. If it means what it says, and judges like to look to the statute as opposed to going to congressional intent, if it means what it says, that there's exclusive jurisdiction, there's no jurisdiction in the Supreme Court. This may come before the court, but what factors would you consider to be relevant in making the analysis as to again, maintaining equilibrium between the court and the Congress of our authority to take away federal court jurisdiction on this important item.
In the area of habeas corpus, there are a number of important principles that have to be considered in reviewing any legislation that is argued to that someone contends has altered habeas jurisdiction. The first is that the court said in a case called INS versus St. Cyr that if there is an attempt to that habeas jurisdiction can't be taken away unless it's clear in the statute that that's what was intended. Habeas jurisdiction is not to be repealed by implication. That's one important principle. And then in Felker versus Turpin, which involved the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, the Supreme Court considered arguments about whether provisions of that legislation, which restructured federal habeas review, violated the Constitution, and they found that there wasn't a violation because the essentials of the writ were preserved. And so, if other legislation is challenged, it would have to be reviewed under standards like that.
Judge Alito, I want to move now to a subject on efforts to have television in the Supreme Court of the United States. Subject very near and dear to my heart. I've been pushing it for a long time, and I'm personally convinced that it's going to come someday. I'm not sure whether it'll come during my tenure in the Senate. More likely to come during the tenure of Chief Justice Roberts in the Supreme Court, or your tenure if confirmed. The Supreme Court said in the Richmond newspaper case versus Virginia that, quote, the rights of a public trial belong not just to the accused, but to the public and the press as well. Such openness has long been recognized as an indispensable attribute in the Anglo-Saxon trial. And there are many other lines of authority, but only a few moments left to set the stage here. But the Supreme Court has the final word. We can talk about the president's war power under Article II and the congressional authority under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but the court makes the decision. We can talk about taking away habeas corpus jurisdiction, but the court decides whether we can do it or not. We can talk about the insult of declaring acts of Congress unconstitutional because of our method of reasoning, but the court can do that. And the court has made these decisions on all of the important subjects. Court decided who would be president of the United States in Bush versus Gore. Court decides who lives on woman's right to choose, who dies on the right to die, on the death penalty, on every critical decision. The Congress has the authority to do many things on the administrative level, such as we set the starting date for the court, first Monday in October. We set what is a quorum of the court, 6 members. Congress sets the size of the court. Effort made by President Roosevelt to increase the number from 9 to 15. We put provisions in on speedy trial, time limits on habeas corpus matters. In recent times, some of those who have objected to televising the court have been on television quite a bit themselves. So when Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer come on TV, it's pretty good. A pretty good show. Not much surfing when that happens, like surfing when my turn comes to question. This proceeding on confirmation of Supreme Court justices has attracted a lot of attention. As I said to you yesterday, I'm tired of picking up the front page everywhere and seeing your picture on it. Brett Hume was on Fox News talking about going to a Redskins game in 1991 when Justice Thomas was being confirmed, and how he had his ear set on to listen to the proceedings. I think Senator Leahy was questioning Professor Hill at that particular time. But how about it? Why shouldn't the Supreme Court be open to the public with television?
Well, I had the opportunity to deal with this issue actually in relation to my own court. A number of years ago, all the courts of appeals were given the authority to allow their oral arguments to be televised if they wanted, and we had a debate within our court about whether we should allow television cameras in our courtroom, and I argued that we should do it. I thought that it would be a useful
education. Really? You've taken a position on this issue?
Well, I did, and this was one of the matters on which I ended up in dissent in my court. I think the majority was fearful that our Nielsen numbers would be in
Could
the negative.
Could you promise the same result? Could you promise the same result, if confirmed, to be a dissenter? Were the court allowed TV?
Be careful how you answer.
Be careful how you answer everything, as you have been.
The issue is a little bit different on the Supreme Court, and it would be presumptuous for me to talk about it right now, particularly since I think at least one of the justices has said that a television camera would make its way into the Supreme Court courtroom over his dead body, so I wouldn't want to comment
on it. Justice Souter, but quite a few of his colleagues have been on television. Well, let me ask you this, Judge Alito. I know what the answer will be with 7 seconds left. Will you keep an open mind?
I will keep an open mind, despite the position I took on the Third Circuit.
Thank you, Judge Alito. We'll now take a 15-minute break, and we'll reconvene at 11:35.
Oh, great.
And you're listening to live coverage of the Samuel Alito confirmation hearings from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan, along with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and David Savage, who's the Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We've just begun the second round of questions. Senator Arlen Specter, the chairman of the committee, taking his opportunity to begin the second round. So we'll come back on the Democratic side with Patrick Leahy at 11:35 Eastern Time, according to the schedule that Senator Specter just announced. And Nina Totenberg, do you think it would be fair to say that Judge Alito has weathered this first round of questions, a long day yesterday and an hour and a half today, that he's weathered it pretty well?
Yes, I think it's fair to say he's weathered it pretty well. I think he's had... Basically, there have been three problem areas for him that the Democrats will use, seize on, whatever. And they frankly, I think they all but one, stem from that job application in 1985 when he was applying for a job as Deputy Associate Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the big legal office for the President of the United States, tells him what he can and cannot do, basically, gives him legal opinions. And obviously the big one is abortion, and in that he said that the Constitution, in his view, does not protect a right to abortion. And because he's not willing to disavow that now, or to embrace it either, simply to say that that was his view then, and he can't say what his view now is, the Democrats have said, will say, we're at being asked to buy a pig in a poke. This is an issue of enormous importance to our constituents, just as some on the Republican side will say the same thing. And we're not going to vote for him as long as we are deeply suspicious that he still abides, holds that view deep in his heart, and will reverse Roe versus Wade. Now, obviously, on the Republican side, he's been nominated in part because there are those perhaps, who hope he'll do precisely that. And then the other issues, and we're going to be joined in a minute by Senator Cornyn, Republican of Texas, and I'll ask him about those. They're more factual. Those involve this group, concerned alumni of Princeton, and the matter involving his initial failure to recuse himself in a Vanguard case. That's a case involving a mutual fund in which he had significant stock interests, not significant in terms of Vanguard, only significant in terms of the judge's own portfolio.
And Senator Cornyn of Texas has been kind enough to join us here in the booth overlooking the hearing room in the Hart Senate office building. Senator Cornyn, good morning. Appreciate your time today. Same question I just put to Nina Totenberg. How do you think that Judge Alito's doing?
Well, I think he's doing fine. It's interesting how Senator Schumer set it up on the first day of the hearing where he said the judge had a triply high standard to meet, to be confirmed. It had a heavy burden to overcome. Whereas my impression has been historically that nominees have, it's been a presumptive confirmation pending some reason that they should be disqualified. So it's interesting how this has been set up. But I think Judge Alito is, he's not necessarily keeping us on the edge of our chairs, but he is demonstrating his legal scholarship, his careful and thoughtful approach to the law. And I don't think sending any shockwaves across the hearing room.
Do you think that he's he's not issued a lot of specifics? He's declined to say. Well, he's declined to say a lot. I think Senator Spector was just saying that he's been extremely cautious.
Well, he has been extremely cautious, and I think with good reason. We talked during the Roberts hearing about the Ginsburg standard, that notwithstanding the fact she had written extensively, there were things she would be willing to talk about, like her former writings, but she wouldn't cross this ethical line and predict or state how she's likely to rule on issues when they come before the court. Judge Alito has answered a lot of questions. To my memory, he's really only declined to answer a couple. What he hadn't done is say how he would rule, but he has talked in almost every instance about the considerations he would take into account when approaching an issue. You know, that's not going to be satisfactory probably to either side because, as Nina was just pointing out, one side wants confirmation of his likelihood he'll vote one way on an issue, and perhaps the other side wants a way confirmation that he'll vote just the opposite. But, you know, here again, I think the great thing about these hearings and perhaps the educational value of these hearings is to remind us all that these are not new debates. They've began with the very origins of this country. They continue today, and that is what the appropriate role of the judiciary is relative to the executive and legislative power. And they're never going to go away. But I think it's been a good hearing so far.
Senator, don't you think in the name of frankness we should say that each nominee draws the line in a different place, that each nominee is willing to say certain things are settled law? This nominee, for example, said yesterday that independent agencies, the existence of those agencies, is a matter that's now settled law. But he's not willing to say that other things are settled law. Justice Ginsburg was willing to say basically that Roe versus Wade, in her view, was settled law. She was not willing to say to comment about the death penalty because she said she'd never handled the issue. Justice Breyer, on the other hand, was willing to say that he thought that the death penalty was settled law. That each of these individuals draws the line in a different place that is, I think, I would say, politically comfortable for that individual.
I've tried to figure out for myself, Nina, what the common theme is here. And I think to the extent to which nominees believe that issues will not be revisited by the court, they're willing to say it's settled law. In other words, if it's old enough and if it's revered enough, like Brown versus Board of Education, for example, everybody is going to say that's a good decision. Thank goodness we revisited Plessy versus Ferguson. But you start getting to those hot-button issues that are
like foreign law, which he says he wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. He has no problem telling us he's not going to use foreign law.
Yeah, that's, I would distinguish that and say that's a method of reasoning as opposed to an outcome. So I would make that distinction for what it's worth. But, you know, I think Senator Spector was probably right. Each nominee is going to answer as many questions as they feel like they have to, but not any more than they feel is necessary to be confirmed. That's part of what he called the subtle minuet.
You know, the thought has occurred to me, this is not something people discuss in public much, but we've just had this question about cameras in the Supreme Courtroom, and I've had sort of a mixed view of it personally, that has relatively little to do with my radio status. But I've always thought that on an intellectual basis, it was hard to make the argument that there shouldn't be cameras in the courtroom. I must say that since we've had a number of attacks on judges, I think that one, there are security reasons, perhaps, not to have the justices of the Supreme Court on television all the time on a daily basis. And we don't talk about that at all, though. I wonder if you have any thoughts about it.
Well, I have strong belief that we ought to allow the same sort of educational function that we've seen during the course of this hearing continue on a case-to-case basis when cases are argued in court. Now, I understand, having been a judge at the appellate level and at the trial level for 13 years in my state in an earlier life, the reticence, and that is because everyone always talks about, well, the O.J. Simpson trial, people playing to the cameras rather than, you know, simply arguing their case on the law and not sort of playing to the peanut gallery. And to me, that's kind of the debate. Frankly, I don't think it's even a close contest.
And what do you get with TV you don't get with audio?
Well, it's just another, it's a visual stimulation as opposed just to an oral stimulation.
I don't know. You don't watch these guys like we do every day. It's pretty unstimulating to watch
them.
Well,
it's pretty, it's good for insomnia. and that's one of the things I think people will learn. It's not Law and Order. It is, real life is serious. It has profound implications and impact on real human beings. And it's very important, but it's not showbiz. I think that's another beneficial thing that people could learn by watching real court proceedings, and particularly at the United States Supreme Court, when the hardest cases get there. I think this is a great part of the conversation that we need to have and that continue to have in this country about who we are and sort of where those lines ought to be drawn.
Isn't your job in these hearings sort of on the Republican side to play defense, in essence? I mean, my sense is that the Democrats are playing offense and you guys are playing defense, and I'm not sure. There may be Democrats who really do want answers to the questions, because after all, half of them voted for John Roberts. But my sense on the Republican side is that you're there like, I don't do football analogies, but whoever those guys are who protect the quarterback.
Linemen.
Linemen, thank you.
Well, rather than playing defense, I would like to characterize it as truth-telling. in all seriousness, I'm trying to make you laugh, Nina, but, it is a back and forth. It's an adversarial process, not unlike the courtroom where the prosecution presents the best case they can and the defense lawyers do the other. I mean, here again, it gets back to what I mentioned earlier about the triply high burden that Chuck Schumer mentioned that this nominee had to withstand, which I think is in effect a double standard. But certainly, I think it's doing part of our job if we feel like this nominee's background has been mischaracterized, to try to do our best to shed other light on it. I mean, ultimately, this is not like a jury trial where you have an impartial third party ultimately deciding who has greater credibility and who to believe and deciding the outcome, because we are the jury. The Senate is going to make that decision. But I think it's important to at least give both sides of the argument so the impartial observers, people who haven't made up their mind, can judge for themselves. The polls that I see tend to indicate that the people who do know something about this nominee on balance, I think it was 54% is the last poll I saw, tend to think he should be confirmed.
I want to ask you one quick question about Vanguard, because I don't see Senator Spector yet in the chair.
We've got 5 minutes, Nina.
And that is that this I hate to use the Democrats' language, but this has puzzled me, frankly. Mm-hmm. Here you have a judge who promises the committee he's not going to participate in Vanguard. He does it in writing. He doesn't actually time limit it in his writing. Then 12 years later, there's this case that he doesn't recuse himself from. And when it's called to his attention, he does recuse himself. He disqualifies himself because he has a higher standard, he says, than what is required under the canons of judicial conduct. And when he's asked about it, there are a variety of explanations. Yesterday, he comes before the committee, and he says that, you know, basically, I goofed. I just didn't notice it. I should have noticed it, and I'm sorry. In the words of the late Lloyd Cutler, he ate the rug, which is what Lloyd Cutler used to tell nominees who goofed to come up here and do. And yet, when he was questioned by Senator Feingold, what it appears is that he never put Vanguard on his recusal list. Mm-hmm. And he can't straighten this out. And judges, particularly one like Judge Alito, are very meticulous people. They keep records. You've been a judge. They keep records of everything they do involving some recusal matters. This is just one of those things. It's a big deal. They keep, and I can't quite figure out why Vanguard apparently wasn't on the recusal list and why there's no record of it.
I personally think, having looked into this thing extensively, I would prefer that he would have just taken the "I goofed" position and left it at that, because, frankly, everybody else who's looked at it, all the legal ethicists that I've seen who've expressed an opinion across the political and ideological spectrum, as well as the American Bar Association, have concluded that he didn't do anything wrong. And ultimately, as you know, he did recuse, which is a voluntary procedure. It's not compelled by some outside tribunal. And so, no harm, no foul. But I agree with you to the extent that you suggest that it's been muddled and kind of unclear, and it doesn't seem like the explanations have been as clear as they should have been. So, but in the end, I conclude, as the American Bar Association Standing Committee on the Judiciary, that there's no real question about this impugning his reputation for integrity. So I think it's a non-issue from that standpoint.
The other subject that I wanted to raise with you is this concerned alumni of Princeton, which the judge is also puzzled about, basically. And I have begun to wonder whether somebody helped him with this application. I realize I'm grasping at straws, but that application points to the fact that he contributed money to what was considered the most aggressive conservative political action committee at the time, that he was looking to burnish his credentials, and that he did it in every way he thought he could, but perhaps was, and then forgot about it. I don't want to give him an excuse that doesn't exist. On the other hand, I can't imagine how you could be a member of an organization that was as strident as CAP was, an organization denounced by your leader, Bill Frist, who was another Princeton alum, and that you wouldn't remember that.
Well, my conclusion from everything we've learned about it is that in his job application at the Reagan White House, he was trying to put his best conservative foot forward and identify organizations and philosophies that he thought would be well regarded by the people hiring him there. The judges also said that he was not actively involved in the organization. Here it again, it's one of those things that is a little bit of a head scratcher. But in the end, I think what really counts is his track record of performance as a federal judge the last 15 years. And there does not appear to be any evidence at all of this judge embracing the radical, as you say, beliefs of CAP, other than he mentioned they're kicking the ROTC off campus, and as a member of the ROTC and his ticket to Princeton education, he wanted to avoid. Present.
Senator Cornyn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. Thank
hearings
you.
Have resumed, and we'll get back down to the floor. Appreciate
Senator
it.
Senator Leahy for 20 minutes.
John Cornyn of Texas speaking with us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Pat Leahy of Vermont resuming the questioning of Judge Alito.
Welcome back. If passes any prologue, you probably don't have another day or so of this to go through, but I am concerned, and I want to just state this right out, right, concerned that you may be retreating from part of your record. And I think that some of the answers, and I've expressed this concern, I mentioned to the chairman, I'm concerned some of your answers were inconsistent with past statements. And all of us want to know your legal and constitutional philosophy. So let's go back to the questions I was asking yesterday about checking presidential power. And we spoke about the Justice Jackson's opinion in Youngstown. Justice Jackson, as you know, is a hero of mine, and I point often to the Youngstown case. But When Congress acts to strain the president's power, as we did with the anti-torture statutes and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, I believe the president's power then is at its lowest ebb. You seem to be saying yesterday that fell into the second category of Jackson, that's the twilight zone. Actually, I believe you were mistaken on that. Justice Jackson spoke of the twilight zone area, or as he said, a zone of twilight, where Congress had not acted. So let's go to landmark decision in Hamdi. Now, and Justice O'Connor's decision, that's whether there was due process required a U.S. citizen can have a meaningful chance to challenge his detention by the government. Now, Justice O'Connor wrote that the president does not have a blank check, even in time of war. And yesterday you told Senator Specter that you agreed with Justice O'Connor's general statement. A very different view was in the dissent. Justice Thomas would have upheld the extreme claims for this all-powerful and essentially unchecked president. He argued the government's powers could not be balanced away by the court, and there is no occasion to balance a competing interest. Which one's right, Justice O'Connor or Justice Thomas? They're quite a bit different.
Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion of the court. The first question that she addressed in Hamdi was whether it was lawful to detain Hamdi, and it was a statutory question. It was a question whether he was being detained in violation of what is often referred to as the anti-detention statute, which was passed to prevent a repetition of the Japanese internment that occurred during World War II, and she concluded that the authorization for the use of military force constituted authorization for detention. And then she went on to the issue of the constitutional procedures that would have to be followed before someone could be detained. And she looked to standard procedural due process law in this area and identified some of the requirements that would have to be followed before someone could be detained. And now issues have arisen about the identity of the tribunal that is to make a determination about detaining people who are taken into custody during the war on terrorism, and that's one of the issues that's working its way through the court system.
No, I'm not talking about the things that are working, but just on Hamdi, that has been decided. Would you say that Justice O'Connor basically applied the Jackson test, not the Twilight Zone test, but the test of where the president's power is at its lowest ebb?
In addressing the statutory question, I don't think she had any need to get into Justice Jackson's framework as well.
But would you say it would be consistent with what Justice Jackson said?
I think it certainly is consistent with what Justice Jackson said.
Which decision do you personally agree with, hers or the dissent by Justice Thomas?
I think that the war powers are divided between the executive branch and the Congress. I think that's a starting point to look at in this area. The president is the commander-in-chief, and he has authority in the area of foreign affairs and is recognized in Supreme Court decisions as the sole organ of the country in conducting foreign affairs.
But you're not going to say which of the two decisions you
I'm trying to explain my understanding of the division of authority in this area, and I think that it's divided between the executive and the Congress. I certainly don't think that the president has a blank check. In time of war, he does have the responsibility as the commander-in-chief, which is an awesome responsibility.
But we all understand that, appreciate that. My understanding, listening to Chief Justice Roberts when he was here saying where you are, that he felt that Justice O'Connor's decision most clearly tracked the Jackson standards in Youngstown. But let's go. I want to get more into this unitary executive theory today, because I really had questions listening to you yesterday. You've said recently, as 5 years ago, that you believe the unitary executive theory best captures the constitutional role of presidential power. You were a sitting judge when you said that. And do you still adhere to that legal and constitutional view that you were expressing 5 years ago?
I think that the considerations that inform the theory of the unitary executive are still important in determining, in deciding separation of powers issues that arise in this area. Of course, when questions come up involving the power of removal, which was the particular power that I was talking about in the talk that you're referring to, those are now governed by a line of precedent from Myers, Humphrey, going through Humphrey's executor, and Wiener, and Morrison, where the court held 8-1 that the removal restrictions that were placed on an independent counsel under the Independent Counsel Act did not violate separation of powers principles. So those would be applied. Those would be the governing precedents on the question of removal. But my point in the talk was that the considerations that underlie this theory are relevant, should inform decision-making in the area, going beyond the narrow question of
removal.
But
in the past, you criticized Morrison. Are you saying now that you're comfortable with Morrison?
Morrison,
you accept it?
Morrison is a precedent of the court. It was an 8-1 decision. It's entitled to respect under stare decisis. It concerned the Independent Counsel Act, which no longer is in force.
Does? So do you hold today that the independent counsel statute was beyond the congressional authority to authorize?
No, I don't think that was ever my view.
To enact. All right. Under the theory of unitary executive that you've espoused, what weight and relevance should the Supreme Court give to a presidential signing statement? I ask that because these are real issues. I mean, we passed the McCain-Warner et al. Statute against torture when the president did a separate sign after he signed it into law. He didn't veto it. He had the right and, of course, the ability to veto it. He didn't veto it. He signed it into law, and then he wrote signing statement basically saying that it will not apply to him or those acting under his orders if he doesn't want it to. Under a unitary theory of government, one could argue that he has an absolute right to ignore a law that the Congress has written. What kind of weight do you think should be given to signing statements?
I don't see any connection between the concept of a unitary executive and the weight that should be given to signing statements in interpreting statutes. I view those as entirely separate questions. The question of the unitary executive, as I was explaining yesterday, does not concern the scope of executive powers. It concerns who controls whatever power the executive has. You could have an executive with very narrow powers and still have a unitary executive. So those are entirely different questions. The scope of executive power gets into the question of inherent executive power.
Well, let me go into that a little bit, because back in the days when I was a prosecutor, I mean, I was very shocked what happened in the Saturday night massacre. President orders certain things doing to be done. The Attorney General says, no, I won't do it, fires him. The Deputy Attorney General said, okay, you do it. And Deputy Attorney General wouldn't, saying violate the law, fires him. They keep on going down. Finally, they find one person, person you've praised, Robert Bork, who says, fine, I'll fire him. I'll do what the president says. You have criticized Congress for allowing these independent agencies to refine and apply policies passed by Congress. You said that insofar as the president's the chief executive, he should follow their policies, not Congress. So let me go into, let's take one for example. The Federal Election Commission, independent agency, they make policies. Suppose the president, whoever was the president, didn't like the fact they were investigating somebody who had contributed to him. Could he order them to stop that investigation?
Senator, I don't think I've ever said that. I don't think I've ever challenged the constitutionality of independent agencies. My understanding.
No, what you said, I want to make sure. My understanding is you chastised Congress for giving so much power to them when the power should be in the president or in the executive.
Senator, I don't think I've ever said that either. I said that I thought that there was merit to the theory of the unitary executive, and I tried to explain how I thought that should play out in the post-Morrison world, accepting Morrison as the Supreme Court's latest decision and a resounding 8-1 decision on the issue of removal. How should the concept of the unitary executive play out in the post-Morrison world? On the issue of removal, my understanding of where the law stands now is that Myers established that there are certain officers of the executive branch whom the president has the authority to remove as he sees fit.
He could fire his whole cabinet today if he wanted to. I mean, don't we all accept that?
Well, that was the issue that was presented by the Tenure in Office Act that led to the impeachment of the first President Johnson. And in Myers, Chief Justice Taft, although the act, that controversy was long past, Chief Justice Taft opined that the Tenure in Office Act had been unconstitutional.
But let's not go off the subject of these independent agencies that we set up. Using the example of the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, could the president, if he didn't like somebody they were investigating, a contributor or something, could he order them to stop?
What Morrison says is that Congress can place restrictions on the removal of inferior officers, provided that those removal restrictions don't interfere with the president's exercise of executive authority. So they adopted a functional approach. And that was the court's latest word on this question. They looked back to Humphrey's executor and Wiener, which had talked about categories, and they understood categories of quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative officers, and they reformulated this as a functional approach, and that's the approach that would now be applied.
Do you believe the president has the power to curtail investigations, for example, by the Department of Justice?
I don't think
the Department of Justice is under him.
I don't think the president is above the law, and the president is the head of the executive branch, and I've explained my understanding of the removal restrictions that can and cannot be placed on officers of the executive branch.
But could he order them to stop an investigation?
Well, you'd have to look at the facts of the case and the particular officer that we're talking about.
Could he order the FBI to conduct surveillance in a way not authorized by statute?
The president is subject to constitutional restrictions, and he cannot lawfully direct the FBI or anybody in the Justice Department or anybody else in the executive branch to do anything that violates the Constitution.
Could he, I'm speaking now of statute, could he order our intelligence agencies to do something that was specifically prohibited by statute?
Well, my answer to that is the same thing. He has to follow the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He has to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. If a statute is unconstitutional, then the Constitution would trump the statute. But if a statute is not unconstitutional, then the statute is binding on the president and everyone else.
Well, does the president have unlimited power just to declare a statute, especially if it's a statute that he had signed into law, to then declare it unconstitutional? He's not going to follow it?
If the matter is later challenged in court, of course, the president isn't going to have the last word on that question, that's for sure. And the courts would exercise absolutely independent judgment on that question. It's emphatically the duty of the courts to say what the law is when constitutional questions are raised in cases that come before the courts.
Now, that's an answer I agree with. Thank you. Another area is SEC. Can he order them to stop an investigation if it's somebody doesn't want to investigate it?
Well, the independent agencies are governed by Humphrey's executor and the cases that follow that. And there have been restrictions placed on the removal of commissioners of the independent agencies, and they have been sustained by the Supreme Court. And that's where the Supreme Court precedent on the issue stands.
Is that settled law?
It is a line of precedent that culminated, I would say. There have been a few additional cases relating to this, the Edmund case and the Freitag case. But I would look to Morrison, which was an 8-1 decision, involving a subject of considerable public controversy, the removal of an independent counsel, removal restrictions on an independent counsel.
Well, I'm still having some difficulty in statements you've made about the unitary form of government and how you would apply it. You suggested in answer to a question I asked that when people's rights are violated, they should have the day in court. Courts are there to protect the rights of individuals. I don't think anybody in this room would disagree with that. It's the practice we look at in PERG versus magnesium electron. You concluded the Congress didn't have the constitutional authority to authorize citizens to bring a suit against polluters under the Clean Water Act. Whether the people had justiciable claims or not, there were a number of people lived downstream from magnesium electron. They said the water had been polluted. They brought a suit. You threw it out. Judge Lewis dissented, said it should have gone back to the lower court on the question of facts. I'll give you a two-part question. One, why did you send that back? And do you accept Laidlaw as being settled law?
Well, magnesium electron presented the question of whether we had a case or controversy under Article 3, and that's the fundamental limit on our jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has said that we do not have a case or controversy before us if we do not have a party that has constitutional standing, which requires injury in fact. And the issue was whether the plaintiffs in that case had established injury in fact. There was a plant that was discharging certain things into a creek, which eventually emptied into the Delaware River, and the plaintiffs in the case alleged that they enjoyed the Delaware River in a variety of ways. They ate fish from the river. They drank water from the river. They walked along the river. But there was nothing in the evidence. And Judge Lewis agreed on this. Judge Roth wrote the opinion. I agreed with Judge Roth. And Judge Lewis agreed with this on this point. There was nothing in the record.
But didn't Judge Lewis agree with you on the legal point? But he suggested sending it back to the lower court to determine whether there were facts to give standing. I mean, we all agree you can't be in a case if you don't have standing. But didn't Judge Lewis say, send it back to the lower court so they can determine on the facts whether there might be standing?
The evidence that was before us did not show that there was any standing on the part of the plaintiffs. They didn't. There was no evidence of harm to the Delaware River in any way from the discharges, and that was the basis of Judge Roth's opinion, with which I agreed. As I recall, Judge Lewis's point was that the case should go back to the district court so that the plaintiffs could have an opportunity to present additional evidence. But as I recall, they were not even arguing before us that they had additional evidence. They were not arguing before us, as I recall, that we have additional evidence and we'd like the opportunity to go back to the district court to present it. That's my recollection of the matter.
And the other part of my question is Laidlaw, settled law.
Well, Laidlaw is a precedent on the Supreme Court, and my answer to the question there is the same. It's entitled to the respect of stare decisis.
Thank you, Senator Leahy. Senator Hatch.
Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
I just want to clarify a few matters. In his questioning this morning, Senator Durbin from Illinois, I think apparently misstated what Chief Justice Roberts said during his confirmation hearings. Senator Durbin claimed that the Chief Justice, said that Roe was the settled law of the land. In fact, that exchange that Senator Durbin referred to was made during the confirmation process for Judge Roberts to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, where he would have to admit that that would be settled law for him in that court. It's beyond question that for a circuit court nominee, the Supreme Court's pronouncements on specific questions are binding precedents and will be the settled law of the land. Moreover, contrary to the distinguished senator from Illinois' suggestion, then-Judge Roberts' testimony at his recent confirmation hearing and your testimony today and yesterday, you've both been entirely consistent in this particular matter. I just wanted to clarify that because there's a difference between a nominee for the Circuit Court of Appeals saying that something is settled law that he has to be bound by, he or she has to be bound by, than by somebody who is a nominee for the Supreme Court. And that's just a matter of clarification that I would like to make at this time. Now, yesterday you were asked some 340 questions by 15 senators, and you're getting a bunch today, and I'm told that you felt that you had to decline to answer only